stand. That's www.churchofmabusradio.com.
To cover Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern with your host, Joe Montaldo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Welcome to another episode of The Dawn of Shades. I'm your host, Gia Scott, and once again, we have another fascinating topic tonight. But before we jump off into that conversation, we've got our usual announcements to make. For tonight's show, like always, I would love to hear from the listening audience. So, please send your questions and comments to me at GiaScott@exogenynetwork.com. And if you don't know how to spell it, it's spelled GiaScott at exogenynetwork, exogenynetwork.com. I promise I will not give out your full name or email, and I won't even send you any spam. So don't be shy. I know you got something on your mind that you would love to have the answer to. And even if you're listening to this on a podcast, go ahead and send me that email. I'll try to get your answers too. Now, when I started doing internet radio, the hardest part was getting used to the absence of instant feedback from my audience. For the live audience, you can get easily see if they're enjoying the presentation or not. With internet radio, feedback is very slow, and sometimes that trickle slows down to a few grains of dust. So, if you have an opinion about this show, please let me know, good or bad. Without that feedback, it becomes a really lonely chore rather than a fun experience of sharing. And besides that, who likes to be lonely? So it's time to do your part to save the sanity of one internet radio host. Email me, and whether it's questions about the program tonight or about something else with the program, go ahead and email me and send it to GiaScott@exogenynetwork.com. Now, tonight's guest is Risa Bear, author and homesteader. Tonight's topic is spring seed catalogs and that perennial optimism and anticipation that the season brings. So, without further ado, I would like to welcome Risa to the show. And Risa, would you be so kind as to introduce yourself to the audience?
All right, I'm a blogger and the editor and publisher of Stony Run Press. I farm 1 acre in the Willamette Valley, Oregon. I retired in 2009 after 20 years at the University of Oregon, and I'm the author of a post-apocalyptic trilogy, Starvation Ridge, as well as other books.
Okay, that was very short today. You want to tell them how to find your blog and books?
All right, well, my blog is located at Risa's Home, all one word, risashome.blogspot.com. And my books are located at lulu.com under www.lulu.com/spotlight/RisaB, R-I-S-A-B-E-E.
Okay. All righty. Well, Risa, I'm sure your mailbox has been very much like mine, and so far this spring, you know, the usual parade of colorful catalogs has been arriving. And, you know, there's something about the arrival of those catalogs that says, "Who's on the way?" And it kind of brings out a little optimism, you know, too. You go through the catalogs and you see all the wonderful possibilities. And, of course, at that moment in time, you forget about the weeding, the planting, the aching back, the sore knees, and your own climate often.
Well, As usual this year, I jumped the gun and get on the websites of the catalog people instead of waiting for their catalogs, because a number of varieties will be bought up before the catalog even comes out. That's happened for about 3 years now.
Mm-hmm.
Fedco Seeds in Maine is my favorite go-to place, and I fill in usually with seeds from Territorial, who are just 10 miles down the road from me.
Uh-huh.
And the things that I'm able to get from them online is they're usually their complete line of stuff. And if I wait for the catalog, I see about 70% of those things are still available.
Uh-huh. That's a big difference, too. You know, and I know a lot of things, you order them at least and often plant them as well in the fall rather than in the spring. Especially for those of us who are like me and live in the South, garlic is a fall crop, and they're usually sold out long before planting time actually occurs for the, mm-hmm. you know, some of the favorite or more exotic varieties that are available. You know, and then too, for a lot of people, this is the, you know, the spring is the time when they plan on planting a new tree or two. I know in my own case, where we just bought the house end of last summer, we didn't plant any trees in the fall. We did plant a couple of hardy kiwis and a couple of blueberries. That was pretty much all we did for planting, you know, the permanent kind of things. We had a lot of overgrowth because this is an old lot and an old house, and time makes things outgrow their space, you might say, and other things become invasive. So you always have to do the destruction on an older landscape lot before you can do the construction. So I'm still tearing out things. I've discovered that there's a bunch of things I have no idea what they are. There's a plant with a really complex kind of lacy leaf. It is quite invasive from what I can see. It grows everywhere that isn't being mowed. And it gets mm-hmm. about 3-4 feet tall. And it's woody. It's a shrub or bush of some sort. And it gets these red berries, which I have no idea if they're toxic. And the cardinals like them, but just because the cardinals like them doesn't mean that my granddaughter, who's a toddler, mm-hmm. can eat them too. So where it's unknown, I'm assuming these really attractive red berries are probably also really toxic. So we've been cutting those out, and I'm looking at a couple of large holly bushes.
Mm-hmm.
And they're probably going to go away too, but they need attacked with a chainsaw, not me with a pair of nippers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So any of the things that you've been tearing out would have three large leaves and climbing trees?
As in potentially poison ivy? I haven't seen, right now, a lot of things don't have leaves, and I'm just ripping out mm-hmm. stems. As far as I know, there hasn't been any poison ivy, but I also know that I've tromped right through it bare-legged and wearing, you know, like Crocs or something, you know, equally mm-hmm. open on the foot. I have never reacted to it, so... You know, it's possible I've yanked it out and didn't even know what I was doing.
That was a perfectly good reason for me to leave the East, was the effect of poison ivy. I even had it in my lungs.
Ah.
But out here, the poison oak, it gets me, but not near. I used to fight forest fires, and I was once tapped on the shoulder when I was chainsawing a fire line, and they said, did you know that you just sawed through half an acre of poison oak? But it worked out. I only got some around the collar.
it's funny because I can identify so many things. I mean, even though as far as the plants of the East, I am rather ignorant still. It's nothing like what I knew, what grew in the West. So we've got some trees, you know, in our own yard that I cannot identify. You know, yes, I can identify live oak, and I have identified our pecan trees. But we have another tree. It's rather attractive, but I have no idea what it is. And I have a number of shrubs or small trees that, there again, I have no idea what they are. Some of them are staying because they're attractive and they're not in a, you know, terrible location. Some of them are staying just because I don't know what they are. We're going to see what they do, make a decision about whether they ultimately go at a future point, because we've got so many other things that, to take out still. Popcorn trees, I can identify them, and they're really awful because it's regarded as a trash tree because it drops these round white beads that kind of look like popcorn. That's their seed pod. And, you know, it'll grow almost anywhere. But not only is it kind of invasive getting into your yard and whatnot, or tree line or whatever, but if you cut it and use it for firewood, you're not going to be very happy because it's the most unpleasant smelling stuff. Burning. It smells like it's been saturated with urine.
Oh,
so
my.
It's, like, really, really gross if somebody throws it on your fire.
Yeah,
I have personal experience with that one. Yeah, I put it on the fire.
Do you still have county agent?
You know, I don't know. How do you find if there is a county agent?
Well, you can start from your state's website, find the State Department of Agriculture, and see if they're working with anyone. Many places, like right here, we don't have the county agent anymore, but their office has been kind of taken over by volunteers who have been through the gardener program, the Master Gardeners. And it's worth locating your local Master Gardeners, and they may be able to assist with identification.
That would be a very useful thing, and useful for anybody else that's listening tonight that's also had the great fortune of inherit purchasing or otherwise acquiring a piece of property that has been somewhat neglected for a few years or longer.
Mm-hmm.
Because at least in the South, when things are not maintained with due diligence, you might say,
mm-hmm.
nature begins to reclaim it. And, you know, it can be a little invasive. I know, like, my neighbors at the back of their lot, bamboo, which is a non-native species that can be invasive,
mm-hmm.
has created these thickets. Now, I looked at it and I said, you know, would you guys mind if I go back here and get some bamboo to use in my garden? And they're
mm-hmm.
like, oh, sure, go ahead. You know, we don't do anything with that. So, you know, I'm going to go and I'm going to cut some of it to use in my garden for bean poles and, you know, all sorts of things. Simply because it's available and free, and that's wonderful. You know, available and free, and, you know, you don't even have to really go because we can walk right there. So that's nice.
Armas virulent invasive is Japanese knotweed. And it looks like bamboo, but it has these big leaves. And it does spread through large underground tubers. And it will come right up through the floor of our potting shed. But we've learned to live with it. We wait until it's about 8 or 10 feet tall, cut it, strip the leaves into the compost, and use the stems as all of our bean poles. And then the second year, they're a little too dry and fragile for that, so they become kindling for the fireplace.
Ah.
So, and sheep will eat it. Chickens will eat it. So there's ways. You can make it into a tea. Like a green tea, and so you can live with the stuff.
Uh-huh.
A number of
now,
species are like that.
I remember when I lived in Arizona, one of the most invasive and unpleasant weeds was called golden thorn, and it was very similar to a tumbleweed, but it was really wicked.
Mm.
And it also apparently had a lot of oil, especially in the seeds, because when you burned it, it would practically explode. And it would make lots of popping as the seeds heated up. It would pop a lot and send out hot sparks. And when you live in a fire-prone area, these weeds would grow at the slightest bit of moisture. And they would get large. And then, like a tumbleweed, they would break loose, and then they would end up against your fence. Well, you don't want that kind of thing building up along your fence, because that's a fire hazard. And if a wildfire starts, can't call them forest fires because there weren't any trees.
Range fire.
Yeah, if a fire would start, it rapidly, and those burn very hot. Mm-hmm. But before they were dead, they were wicked with the thorns. If you had reached and grabbed one, you were going to regret it. Another one that was even more wicked with the thorns, although it wasn't as big of a problem with fire, was called camel thorn. And it was an imported weed that was brought in to stabilize arid soil and so forth and so on. And it was also invasive and non-native and a big mistake. And northern Arizona had a lot of it, sort of like the tamarack tree. Tamarack trees were brought in to stabilize.
Mm-hmm.
And what they would do is suck springs dry, literally suck dry. And they're virtually impossible to kill. Even if you cut them off, within like 5 minutes, they've sealed themselves so that your usual compounds that you use to kill trees won't work.
Hmm.
And they're fire resistant.
Oh. Do you have seeds that you're putting in this winter into any kind of potting shed yet?
No, I don't have a potting shed, and I haven't started them on my kitchen table or anything like that yet.
Well, brand new kitchen table.
brand new old kitchen table. It's been unseasonably warm. Today it was in the upper 70s. So it's been really, really warm today. I guess they're threatening us with severe storms and some areas around us with possible tornadoes during the night tonight even. The breeze has eased up a little bit. It was pretty windy all day today. But I did pick up traditional winter crops in this area, lettuce, carrots, kale, Swiss chard, things that are frost-resistant.
Mm-hmm.
And I just finished my second raised lasagna bed thing, and so they're going to get planted with some greens and carrots and whatnot. Mm-hmm. So we'll have those before it gets really warm, and then we'll change what we have planted as those things come out.
Well, there you go. We have an eye towards the early spring here, and I did not plant broad beans in the fall, which I've had some success with in the past, because we have the chickens and ducks cleaning the garden, and we're not ready to fence them out yet.
Uh-huh.
And they are, the chickens are scratching up, and the ducks are burrowing with their beaks, and they're finding slug eggs and that sort of thing. So we want to keep them doing that for a while longer. So the broad beans just went into pots last week, along with some peas. Then this week I put spinach and two kinds of lettuce and kale in flats. There's plenty of kale in the garden, but it's already a year old. It was planted last spring.
Uh-huh.
And the chickens and ducks are working on that, but they leave plenty for us. So we've got 5 flats right now in the potting shed, which is just a very narrow room attached to the chicken shed with a sliding glass door built into the south wall for a greenhouse window. So all the plants are in that window, and they're waiting for things to come up.
Uh-huh. Well, I don't know if I will get ambitious enough to start using a greenhouse or not, or a mm-hmm. potting shed. We will see. This year I'm not going to have a huge garden, simply because it takes a while to get things ready.
Mm-hmm.
And if I don't have them ready, there's no sense in beating myself up, I guess. So while I'm still trying to clean out things and whatnot, I have two raised beds that I have already put in, which are 4x8, and I hope to put in two more before spring. We'll see if I get that far or not. We don't know. And, you know, there again, like I said, I'm not going to beat myself up over it, but yeah, I'm using the lasagna gardening kind of technique simply because digging is one of the things that can't really do anymore. So I'm avoiding the digging.
No, we haven't dug in a long time, actually about 15 years. When we want to do a bed in the fall, we spread cardboard that's had all the plastic tape stripped off, nice and flat, and cover it with straw, about 6 inches of straw. And over the winter, that discombobulates a little bit, and come spring, we can take a right-angled trowel shaped a little bit like a small mattock, and just punch right through the cardboard and plunk the start out of the pot into the ground right there, and then pull the straw up around it.
Uh-huh. And well, I start off with cardboard and paper, and I layer that about an inch thick. And then it gets packed leaves, which are, in our case, it happens to be mostly oak and pecan leaves is what we have. So then those are packed tightly for 3 or 4 inches at least. And then on top of that goes some composted manure, which I have to buy since I have no animals other than dogs and cats. So I buy the composted manure, and I put some of that over the top of the leaves. And then I'll use a commercially bought compost simply because I didn't want to wait until I had my own compost.
So sure.
I bought some organic compost to use. It's,
well, we have two decades on you for accumulating compost.
Yeah, you know, I'm still working on it. I did discover that the leaves, because the bed that I just finished today, I had packed, I'd done the cardboard when it was still warm last fall, cardboard and paper, and then it got its leaves in October, I guess it was, when we did the leaves on it. And they'd been packed, and they'd just been left there, you know, in the approximate shape. And then, you know, it took a while, and we just recently put the frame around it, and then I put more leaves and did the sprinkle and stomp routine. Toddler assistance was of dubious value, but she had a really good time jumping on the leaves. But there again, like I said, dubious assistance, because then she wanted to kick them up again. It's much more fun to watch them blow, I guess. So, you know, then we got that packed on there, you know, so that we had at least 3 or 4 inches everywhere. And it was more or less level, because the area I was putting the bed in was sloped a little bit. So I'd used the packed leaves to kind of level things out. And then we put the frame on top of that, and then packed in more leaves. And so that was our starting point. Before the then the layers of the compost and whatnot, so it looked pretty good. And then my dog decided to make herself a bed in it, and she's gotten fixed where she can't get at it again.
Maybe a little pinch there.
Well, yeah. In our case, our yard is not fenced, and we have a very busy street. So I actually use a cable to keep her from wandering to where she's not supposed to be. And the cable got moved so that she could no longer reach that. Also because she decided that if she was going to have a tantrum, she was going to chew on the steps. And I really wasn't enthusiastic about the idea of trying to pull splinters out of a dog's mouth.
Well, that's certainly...
Or having my steps chewed, you know, yeah.
Beats porcupine quills.
Yeah, she never had a porcupine encounter, and I hope to say that forever and a day. She's not a young dog now, so a porcupine encounter would be quite painful.
No kidding.
Take her a while.
You might consider the vet. We have used side-cutting pliers. You cut the end quill off, and that lets the air out of it, and then it's easier to pull.
Ah.
It pressurizes with the fact that it's hollow and sealed. Makes it like a little tiny, long, skinny balloon with barbs on it.
Yeah, she's deaf to rats and possums.
Mm-hmm.
But I try to minimize her encounters with wildlife, to be honest.
Good.
And she's old now, so she's well-behaved. I mean, she's had 11 years of training, so
Yay. She
is well-behaved. But, you know, accidents do happen. So, yeah. They always happen.
Will your garden be somewhat shady?
The two bits I put in now, I put in some of the only places that get sun at least most of the day.
Mm-hmm.
Both of them will be shaded in the afternoon. That's unavoidable. I mean, there's just no way around it. That may not be a bad thing in the south, though, because we do get some pretty intense sun.
That's right. So you might not have to be as careful about that as we are.
Yeah.
We're on the 44th parallel, and while the summer days are even longer than yours, if it should go up to as high as 100 in the daytime, it can still fall below 60 at night.
Yeah, that's one big difference between the east and the west, is that cooling at night. I discovered that things that I'd grown very, very easily in the desert don't like life in the south.
Mm-hmm.
Even though it's not as hot, that we don't have that cool down at night.
Mm-hmm.
So far, I have to admit, I have not successfully grown tomatoes. That's still something I have yet to accomplish. So this year, I'm not going to focus on tomatoes. I'll put in a couple, try some different varieties again.
Mm-hmm.
See what happens, but I'm not going to focus entirely on the thing.
Mm-hmm.
I do want to have a couple of eggplant. I want to have some herbs. I happen to like a pole bean called the asparagus bean, which is a long bean. They're very prolific. They grew well for me in the desert. I'm hoping they'll do well here. We'll see. So I'm going to put in one hill of those, and we'll see. I found a source for the New Zealand spinach that grew so well for me in the desert. So we'll see if it does well here in the south. Baker Creek Seeds has it. Heirloom Seeds has it. And it was an herb or a green that it tastes very similar to spinach. But it was heat resistant, much more heat resistant than Swiss chard.
Okay.
And, it grew very, very well for me, even when it was hitting 120.
Well, the things that do that for us here are not even in the garden, or at least not in our garden. I've already seen them down the street, and it's called lamb's quarters. And lamb's quarters is, it's an amaranth.
Mm-hmm.
And it grows wild all over here, and especially in disturbed soils. And I remember it in Georgia, too, which is where I'm from. So it covers a lot of territory. When I was traveling along the Willamette River a couple of years ago with a friend kayaking, we found enough lamb's quarters on every island basically to feed ourselves over and above what we had with us. And the stuff is wonderful. It tastes just like spinach, but with a little bit of nutty, almost walnut kind of hit to it. And contains more nutrients than just about any vegetable you can grow.
Now, one green that I ate raw as a child, my mother ate raw as a child, and we only know Popeye spinach. Well, obviously, if you try searching for Popeye spinach on the internet, you're not going to have much success in finding this green that grew wild. It's a real low-growing green There's a number of other weeds that closely resemble it, but they have small, maybe a half inch long oval leaves, and they're kind of fleshy, and they grow real low to the ground. I mean, they kind of sprawl out just right on the ground, and I don't remember ever eating the stems. We picked the leaves off and ate them. And they grow in disturbed ground. It was something that would grow in the garden. It was something that will grow in other disturbed ground. And we ate the heck out of it as kids. My mom did, too.
Out here, what we have that kind of answers to that description is called miner's lettuce. And it's very nutritious. Tree planters used to eat it as they were working across the clear cuts. I believe Scott Coleman grows it in Maine in the wintertime, right through the winter in his greenhouses.
I will have to look at miner's lettuce and see if it looks like the plant I'm describing. I've never seen it in Louisiana or Mississippi. It grew in Arizona, it grew in New Mexico, it grew in Iowa, it grew in Minnesota. But as far as whether it grows here, I don't know. I have no idea. So I've not seen it, but there again, you know, disturbed ground here is quickly taken over by grass and vines and shrubs and trees and all sorts of other things. So it would be quite a challenge to keep up with the growth of other things.
Indeed.
The amazing number of things that can become vining. On the west side of our house, or of the garage actually, was a shrub that had been planted. Similar to some of the shrubs used in other locations around the house. Foundation planting type shrub, you know. But it had sent up these really long, spindly, like water shoots from the shrub that were clinging to the wall of the garage. They weren't true vines, but they were obviously using the building for support and causing damage to the siding, so they were cut away. But the sheer number of vining things here is in the South is amazing.
Now, you know, growing succulent, I just looked it up. You might have been eating purslane. P-U-R-S-L-A-N-E.
I will have to check on that one, too. See which one it may have been. You know, I know that it tasted good. We ate a lot of it. I remember showing it to my kids. I don't know how much of it they ate. It wasn't something that grew a whole lot when we were in Arizona because there was so little agriculture, and it was so arid, you know, so there wasn't a whole lot of it growing. But you would find it in your yard occasionally and or in your garden. But there is a number of heirloom plants that are today considered weeds, and once upon a time they were things that people planted.
This is true. I've known people to spread pokeweed in Georgia and Florida in order to have some to eat. And back in the day it was also popular for making ink from the berries. It's a poisonous plant, but if you catch it before it's about 8 inches tall, cook those leaves down and then throw the first water away, you will end up with something very much like spinach and highly nutritious. We don't have it around here.
I'm thinking pokeweed was one our neighbor was telling us about. She was telling us about some of the wild greens that she had eaten. She's a little bit older than me. And my mother is visiting too, so we were visiting with her, and she was telling us about some of the things that she had eaten as a kid, and that they picked and whatnot. And she knows a lot of the traditional Southern soul foods that I really don't have any familiarity with. you know, some foods I've just never, ever tried. Mm-hmm. If you gave me a bucket of chitlins, I'm afraid I wouldn't know what to do with them. Whereas if you give me a bucket of mountain oysters, I know exactly how to cook them.
Well, in the last couple of centuries, the majority of poor, very poor Southerners were eating either collards or poke salad in season. Poke salad's kind of a spring thing. Collards you can eat year-round. They're a little bitter in the summer, and they're very nice in the winter.
Yeah, and you see them in the gardens. You know, now that I recognize what that plant is, this time of year, in mm-hmm. January, they look like this palm tree stalk.
That's right.
With a cabbage perched on top.
Uh-huh. That little cabbage perched on top is very succulent. Cut up and steamed makes an absolutely fabulous cooked green. You can live year-round on that and the occasional squirrel.
Well, I know that collard greens, I've discovered that I really do like them.
Mm-hmm.
I remember some of the greens that my grandmother made, and I wasn't really crazy about them, but I don't know for sure what it was. Because there's collard greens, there's mustard greens, there's beet greens,
mm-hmm.
there's turnip greens, and there's, of course, your spinaches,
mm-hmm.
and your Swiss chard. You know, so there's a lot of different kinds of greens. I happen to be in love with kale. Okay, I love curly kale. I don't know why, I just think it's wonderful.
Well, genetically, they're almost the same plant as collards. And each has its own specialties in terms of what the nutrients are, but they have a very common lineage along with cabbage, or for that matter, broccoli, Brussels sprouts, and cauliflower.
Mm-hmm. Now, I've raised broccoli before, and broccoli mm-hmm. is absolutely, I grew it on the desert, but I grew it in the wintertime. And, okay, granted, you get that nice, big, pretty head like you buy at the grocery store. But then came the best part, the side shoots and mm-hmm. even the leaves we liked.
But what we do...
We would trim off the side shoots and some mm-hmm. of the leaves, and that was wonderful stuff.
Oh, you bet. We're really eye to eye on that one. what we do is we try to keep all of those going to the extent possible, along with bok choy and a few other things. And all those side leaves, the great big leaves on the kale and the collards and cabbage and so on that ordinarily people would ignore when they're taking a head or whatever, we cut those off in the summertime, July, August, when there's enough solar heat, which is not that easy to come by here, but we get about 2-3 months where we can solar dehydrate well. And we put all those leaves in solar dehydrators, which we make ourselves, and after about 2-3 days, they become very light and airy, kind of like onion skin paper. And I take all those leaves out and strip them by hand, strip all the leaf matter off the stems and bang, great big bowl, and then crumble up. And what you get looks like Italian, all of the nutrients you would expect to find in all those different species of greens. And you can also do the same with some of your herbs and mix them in. And what you've got there is a seasoning that can be used in any quantity. It can be kind of speckled on some kind of egg dish or potato dish, and it will look just like the home and garden photograph. Or you can pile it into a pot, add water, cook, and you've got a vegetable soup.
Mm-hmm. Definitely easy, you know. I can now, here in the South, the humidity makes solar drying very, very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
But I do have, you know, an electric thermostatically controlled dehydrator to sort of combat that situation.
Way to go where you are.
Yeah, yeah, because, like I said, it's very difficult with humidity when you're running on a low humidity day at 80%, I've discovered a number of things that I did, even cooking-wise, in mm-hmm. the West is impossible here. You cannot get, some things don't will never have the right texture. Cookies are all going to be rather cake-like compared to what I was used to. You cannot mm-hmm. make a crisp or sandy textured cookie. It just won't happen.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no sense of beating yourself up. I've tried adjusting recipes and whatnot. And I've now managed to get my peanut butter cookies where the first day they are somewhat sandy. And that's just the way it is. After that, they're going to be soft. But, you know, I've had to adjust so many things because of that humidity. And it's also created issues as I'm learning to garden, learning about the heat and humidity and the issues that it brings. A lot of plants really are stressed immensely, either by fungal infections, diseases, or their sheer refusal to thrive. They may stay alive, but refusal to thrive in a hot and humid climate.
Mm-hmm. Hot and humid.
Yeah. It's not my favorite thing either. I often wonder, how did anybody live in the South before the invention of the air conditioner?
Well, when we get the 100-degree hot spells here, and they do happen, it's a dry heat. I actually fought fire when it was, I didn't think it was that bad. That said, 2 or 3 days of that can really build up in a house, and so we painted the roof white, and that saves us about 15 degrees, oddly enough.
Uh-huh.
So that's something more people could look into, I think.
Well, yeah, and I had looked at, because here in the next year or so we need to put on new shingles or something.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked at roofing alternatives that I could find, you know, online doing research. White shingles are not real common. I could order them, but their success rate was very low.
Mm-hmm.
Because you could actually find charts that compared your different kinds of roofing material.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't score very well. Then there was other alternatives in addition to white metal roofs.
Mm-hmm.
So
white metal is used quite a lot in Florida.
Yeah, retrofitting an old house with a white metal roof can be a rather expensive little adventure,
mm-hmm.
I'm afraid. And if you put a bad metal roof on,
mm-hmm.
I don't think it would do you much good.
Well, what
Keeping
we did,
the rain out or the sun off.
We put roll roofing right on top of an old layer of three-tab asphalt shingle, mm-hmm. and the roll roofing was the same material, just easier to put on because you roll it out, and there's your 25 or 50-foot section done. And on top of that, with a broom, we spread the white goop that is used for sealing the roofs of trailers.
Mm-hmm.
And that ended up with a roof that looks kind of as if it had been thatched with ice cream, but we love it because it really takes good care of us.
Yeah. Our house is interesting. We live in the town where Masonite was manufactured.
Mm-hmm.
And our siding is from the 1940s, and
mm-hmm.
it's Masonite coated with asphalt.
I've seen that. It's
yeah,
kind of rare.
Especially since it hasn't been manufactured in like over 50 years now.
Mm-hmm.
Because it wasn't considered a very good siding. Well, it's lasted on this house. Unfortunately, the color is now somewhat like dirty Pepto-Bismol.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just, it's really not my color. I keep looking at it going, ugh. In addition to the fact that, you know, we have, what, nearly 70-year-old, 60, 70-year-old siding.
Bubblegum pink?
Well, it may have been bubblegum pink a long, long time ago, but it's not anymore. You know, I don't know if it's mildew and moss or what, but it's This nauseating brownish pink.
Well,
yeah, so it's...
Opportunity.
It's slated for replaceable at the first economic opportunity. In addition, for anybody who's not familiar with construction in the South, old houses are built with a 2x4 frame and diagonally placed wide boards, one usually about an inch thick, mm-hmm. that are put over the top of that, and then the siding went on. Forget the vapor barriers or insulation, that was not used. So obviously we've got some updating to do on that department too. So we've been exploring what kind of insulation could be used in, you know, when we go to re-side. And my husband has a lot of experience with construction and renovation and remodeling and restoration. And so, you know, he knows about a lot of materials that I wasn't familiar with. So, yeah, he was telling me just recently about a type of insulation sheeting that we can put up a vapor barrier, then the insulation, then the siding.
Mm-hmm. Well,
still a major project.
Yeah. This old house has a lot of examples of that, I think, and various ways of... sometimes there's sandwiched material that you can get that you just plunk it on there, and it does all three layers at once.
Well, I was hoping for such a thing,
mm-hmm.
that there was a all-in-one, you know, vapor barrier insulation and siding in a single panel that you could put up there that wasn't going to be but ugly. Most of the houses in the area are roughly the same age, but mm-hmm. most of them have been re-sided with brick siding of some sort. Some mm-hmm. are better than others. So there's some that have also used very poor quality vinyl siding, which I've said, you know, I really don't think we want to use that stuff because it looks horrible. It warps, you know, and it is often applied by people who didn't really know how to handle the material, so it probably wasn't put on right. So the warping and disfigurement and issues with moss and mildew seem to be even more obvious for some reason. And I was like, I'm really not thrilled with the vinyl siding. At the same time, you know, we're like most people in America, and you're concerned about cost, even when you're just exploring what you want to do, you know, when you go to do it. You still have to consider cost. I mean, you can find some wonderful siding materials out there if you're a millionaire, but if what millionaire is going to be buying a 1940-something house in an old neighborhood?
Mm-hmm. Well, this one was built in the 40s, and what you're describing sounds familiar. We have 2x6s in the walls, but they are covered with that diagonal board, and then over that is really ancient, very easily crinkled builder's paper. And over the builder's paper is the exterior siding, which is tongue and groove 1x10s, vertical. And if we were going to redo this, we would pull off the 1x10s and clean off the builder's paper, bore 2-inch diameter holes near the top between each pair of studs, and use blown-in insulation, then wrap the house in Tyvek, and then put the 1x10s back on, because they're in actually pretty good shape, even though they're 60 years old.
We looked at, having spent months on the house hunting routine, we looked at many, many old houses.
Mm-hmm.
I happen to be really fond of old houses, and my husband's really fond of making me happy. So
he'll come up with something good.
Yeah, so we looked at a lot of these old houses, and I saw some that I really, really loved. However, by the time we calculated what it would cost to get it, not completely restored, but restored where to the point we could live with it, it was going out of our price range, because, you know, you always, when you buy a piece of property that needs renovation, you always have things that need done right now things that need done in the relatively short term, and then things that need done in the long term. Mm-hmm. And so this right now thing, you know, you had your total price, mm-hmm. and your purchase price, and your right now had to be, you know, in budget. And when you have to replace all of the wiring, all of the plumbing, all of the fixtures, mm-hmm. All of the windows, and, you know, before long you're in, don't forget heating and cooling, mm-hmm. before long your budget has gone,
achoo.
Oh yeah, yeah. We bought a house that was technically ready to move into. Mm-hmm. It needed a lot of cosmetic work. And then it has things that are on the relatively short term, with new roof, new siding, some updating on plumbing, and rewiring.
You'd think they would have Medicare for houses.
You wish. You wish, yeah. You know, and the thing is that this is a really well-built house, and we're really happy with it. And the layout mm-hmm. is only slightly strange, but I will tell you right now that the people that owned the house before were hoarders. They hoarded everything.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I mean, if anybody needs any TV trays, the old TV dinner foil trays mm-hmm. that, you know, were divided and they went in the oven and then you ate them in front of the TV, I guess,
mm-hmm.
We have a stock of them. You know, the things that were hoarded, parts for the broken parts on things that were replaced. They kept the broken parts, too.
Didn't she find a suit from the 1950s or something?
Oh, a suit from the 40s, along with World War II uh-huh. uniforms and clothing.
Okay, there's got to be a use for that.
Yeah, well, I'll probably list it on eBay, so anybody who's looking for World War II memorabilia, I even found out about the Forgotten Branch of Service. I didn't know that we had one. It was the United States, because the United States Maritime Service.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I have a trainee World War II coat. Branch of Service became ultimately the Merchant Marine, I believe.
That's right.
But they supplied, they were employed, they were... They recruited just like all the other branches of service, and they were also sometimes in combat situations, and many of them were killed delivering supplies to ships and whatnot all over the place. So, yeah, it's the Forgotten Branch of Service. And so that, you know, I did learn something in the process of figuring out what is this. You know, I knew it wasn't Marine Corps, but yeah, it was the United States Maritime Service. And apparently they had done a fair amount of recruiting in the South.
That makes sense.
So, yeah, I did learn about that, and I learned all about why we do not want to hoard.
Ah.
Because we bought the house with the junk. The family had come in and gotten what, and had literally emptied dressers onto the floor, and then took the furniture that they wanted. Bookshelves looked like they'd just been literally tipped to dump the books out. So yeah, it was interesting. Some things we look at it and we kind of scratch our head. Drawer full of kitchen utensils with these strange-looking little plastic things, and we couldn't figure out what they were. But there was a patent number on one of them, and looking it up, we discovered they were birthday candle holders designed to insert around the perimeter of the cake so you didn't get wax on the cake. So, yeah.
There you go.
Yeah, intriguing and strange.
Did you find any garden tools?
There were some in the shed and the workshop. Wow. Nothing real of real incredible value or interest. Nothing really old either. Just some useful things. But we are now getting close to time for our break. So, while we are away from your computer, stay tuned. Check out Reese's blog. And we'll also get some questions in from our listening audience. I'm checking the email as I'm talking here. And we can answer your questions when we come back. So stay tuned and we'll be right back.
We'll be right back. Hello, everyone. Trish Sheridan, host of A Global Focus. Join us each Friday evening at A Global Focus's new time, 9 to 11 p.m. Eastern. Come join the discussion.
Light up your night with The Kevin Smith Show. Hi, this is Kevin Smith. Join me Monday through Friday right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Breaking news. Strange black pyramid UFO ships over every major city on the Earth. People are exhilarated and scared. Reptilian strange creatures are beaming down. My God! My God! They're beaming me up with them. Don't put that probe there. Don't put that probe there. Don't put a... Listen to the Church of Mabus radio show at 11 p.m. Eastern, Saturday nights with host Jeffrey Pritchett, bringing you The High Strange. Visit www.churchofmabusradio.com. That's www.churchofmabusradio.com.
In to the Mind Cemetery with your hosts Chip and Nicole every Monday night at 9 p.m. Eastern.
Exclusive UFO Paranormal Radio Network. We delve into UFOs, abductions, ghosts, aliens, conspiracies, and cryptozoology.
And how could you ever forget about those creepics you won't hear on your local news?
This is where I would insert my obligatory skeptical statement. The Mind Cemetery, where the paranoia about the paranormal comes to rest.
Follow us on Twitter and subscribe to us on Facebook. Also, check us out on our website, mindcemetery.com, for show updates and the critically acclaimed Mind Cemetery blog.
It's not critically acclaimed, but you should check it out anyway, mindcemetery.com.
Hi, everybody. This is Erica Getch. I hope to see you on Friday at 8 p.m. Pacific on the Galactic Connection. Keeping you connected 1 hour at a time. For more information, please visit thegalacticconnection.com.
Hey, hi there. Got your attention? I'm Gia Scott, and I was curious what you were doing from 7 to 9 p.m. Central Time on days. See, I host this really interesting little radio program that airs live then, and we bring in all sorts of guests. Authors, experiencers, and everything in between. It's paranormal and guaranteed to make you go, My guest list is always up at www.giascott.com, and do tune in to the Dawn of Shades from 7 to 9 p.m. on Tuesdays.
Tune in to UFO Undercover, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, Joe Montaldo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Well, maybe. Welcome back to the Dawn of Shades. I'm your host, Gia Scott, and tonight we are talking with Risa Bear. Now, folks, don't forget, you can send your questions in to my email, giascott@exogenynetwork.com. And before we get started again, Risa, while we were talking on break, you were telling me about these videos you have on YouTube. You want to tell everybody where they can find them, and they have more in-depth information about some of the topics we've been talking about tonight.
Okay, well, if you go to www.youtube.com/user/RisaSB, RISASB, you'll see about 20 videos there, and most of them are about either Stony Run Farm, which is our acre here in Oregon, or about things like seeds and seedlings things to do with your wood heat stove, dehydrating vegetable leaves, building a dehydrator, making nutrient-dense breads, emptying out goose eggs for decor, and so on.
Pretty cool stuff. Pretty cool stuff. Yeah, you know, the seed catalog thing gets me every year because when I look through the seed catalogs, I get really optimistic. And, you know, of course, the first list that you make of things I want soon gets trimmed down as you realize that you would, you know, have a bill for your seeds equivalent to the national debt, perhaps. But, you know, you do have to downsize things. And, you know, this year I know I only want to plant enough that I can actually cope with it. Some of the things I'll wait, and I'll just buy locally available plants simply because I only want one or two.
Mm-hmm.
It's not practical for me to get too excited about it right now. But eventually, I do want to get more involved with heirloom plants and grow them exclusively. And seed saving is a big thing, but a lot of people really don't know that much about how to do it. You've got quite a bit of experience at saving seed, don't you, Risa?
Well, some. We saved our own potatoes for years, even though we're not supposed to, and never had a problem. We've seeded with tomato seeds, kale seeds, peas, beans, corn, sunflowers, and favas.
And, you know, I guess I have vivid memories of one year I was growing a number of melons, a number of squashes, a number of cucumbers. And in the mix of things I was growing was a vegetable that's typically called the Armenian cucumber,
mm-hmm.
which is a very mild cucumber-like vegetable. But one thing to remember, it is not a true cucumber. It is a melon, and it ended up causing was I had some problems with cross-pollination.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I didn't save seeds, it affected the stuff I was picking that year. I would pick, cantaloupe seemed to be the one that was most likely to be affected.
Mm-hmm.
But I would have cantaloupe-flavored Armenian cucumbers, which were really disgusting, and I would have cucumber-flavored melons, which weren't much better. Thankfully, at that point, I had chickens, and they would eagerly devour either one, but I was usually the sucker who tasted it first to make sure it was, you know, appropriately flavored. I only had them apart maybe by 50 feet, and obviously it wasn't enough. But, you know, are there other things that cross-pollinate that affect your crop now, or are most things just cross-pollination going to affect with your seeds?
Well, it can depend on a numbers. For example, scarlet runners are a different kind of thing from green beans, so you can interplant or grow your green beans very close with your scarlet runners, and everything will breed true from the pod. But if you have two different kinds of green beans or two different kinds of scarlet runners, they can goop each other up.
How about wax beans? Do they cross-pollinate with green beans?
I think of wax beans as being green beans, but you might want to look into that.
Okay.
I plead a good deal of ignorance around these things, actually.
Well, and like I tend to grow the asparagus bean, okay, that's an Asian type of bean,
mm-hmm.
but I'm not sure if it's a true green, what we would call a green bean or not. And then you've got the beans that you grow for dry beans, like, and some of them are dual purpose. You can eat them as green bean
mm-hmm.
or as a dry bean. And, you know, so you really have to be conscious of where you're planting things and how far the bees are going to transfer the pollen,
mm-hmm.
as well as wind and other insects, before you have an issue.
Well, we have that concern here with pumpkins and squashes. We like to grow several different kinds at once, all in together, and so we just don't save the seed from those. start over every year. We do try to use seed that doesn't have Monsanto's horrible imprimatur all over it, but with a little research you can do that. And so we'll put out 3 or 4 different kinds of winter squash, 2 kinds of summer squash, 2 kinds of pumpkins, all out there at one time. Harvest everything, dry it, use it. We did make a mistake one year and used pumpkin seeds over again that we really should have eaten. And what we got was a pumpkin zucchini genes in it. And so they were kind of zumpkins.
Uh-huh.
Very long, skinny pumpkins with alligator stripes from the kind of zucchini we were growing the previous year. And we went ahead and kept them, and they turned out to keep well over the winter, and we just cooked them up all winter long for the chickens. You would cook it till it was a certain amount of soft, and then just throw it over the fence like a football. It would explode, and they would come running and eat everything. And so that's how we disposed of those seeds, and never had that problem again.
Uh-huh. Yeah, zumpkins. Now, for everybody who's listening, if you're curious about pumpkins, not all pumpkins look like Cinderella's pumpkin or the typical jack-o'-lantern pumpkin.
Mm-hmm.
And not all pumpkins are created equal for whatever purpose. Pumpkins can come in pear shapes, sort of bell shapes. They can be squatty. They can be round. They can have a higher water content. They can be highly fibrous. Or they can be dense and meaty with a small seed cavity. So, you know, they do come in a huge variety. I was reading about something called a Seminole pumpkin. And pumpkins aren't something that do well, usually in the South, I'm told. I haven't tried yet. But the Seminole pumpkin is a heirloom variety with a long history in Florida. And while they're not real attractive and you wouldn't want to use them for your jack-o'-lanterns, I usually don't grow pumpkins for jack-o'-lantern purposes myself anyhow. So I was thinking about possibly trying something like that. There was a pumpkin that was grown in Arizona, I'm thinking it was typically called the Hopi pumpkin, and it was and it was sort of pear-shaped with the blossom end being kind of flat. That's where it would sit.
Mm-hmm.
And it made really good candy and pies.
Yay.
Yeah. Now,
we like ours small. They should be able to fit into a stock pot on top of the wood heat stove and cook for several hours and then be fished out and cut in half. The content scooped out for the chickens and ducks, and then the all the flesh around the rind, one of us gets one half and the other one gets the other half, and it's filled with a stuffing of something like, say, rice with sausage, uh-huh. And a little bit of whatever vegetables are handy.
When I stuff pumpkins, I usually choose a small pumpkin. Some buy them at the grocery store.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll admit, I cut them and gut them raw. And I typically cut the top where it forms a lid.
Mm-hmm.
And then I stuff them. It's a mixture. I usually prefer to stuff them with wild rice, some kind mm-hmm. of meat.
Mm-hmm.
It's seasoned with sage and will have onions and celery and mushrooms and a little whatever else sometimes. And that's what I stuff them with.
Mm-hmm.
And another thing I do, and I've done this in campfires many, many times, which for some reason people who aren't real adventurous find amazing, intriguing, and absolutely fascinating. I just put in some brown sugar and some bacon or butter or whatever,
mm-hmm.
Wrap it up in foil and tuck it in the coals around the campfire.
Yeah. And before long, it'll be soft and ready to eat. And sometimes I'll put cinnamon and nutmeg on it. Sometimes I don't. Depends on what. And we'll eat it as dessert, really. And they're absolutely wonderful then.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Like I said, I'm coming right over.
I have to be a big fan. I've done it with squash the same way in a campfire.
Mm-hmm.
But cooking them whole and cutting them then, because sometimes some of these winter squash, they're incredibly hard.
Well, the delicatas, they don't take very long at all. The butternut's a little bit longer, and of course they're not very hollow, so you have to scoop some out and save it for other uses. But typically I've prepared the rice in the steamer, and it's just a matter of combining ingredients and then just dumping it into the shell to be spooned out. Mm. It's very popular in our house.
Mm-hmm. Well, stuffed pumpkin or stuffed winter squash, whichever, mm-hmm. For anybody who's never tried it, it's a whole new way to try it. I grew up with usually winter squash just had brown sugar and bacon put in them, and they were baked that way.
Mm-hmm.
I loved them that way, and the first time I saw a recipe to stuff one, I was like, I don't know. And so eventually I did try it, and I was like, you know, that's really, really good. And I've also stuffed the Halloween jack-o'-lantern type pumpkin, mm-hmm. which, you know, with its high water content and more fibrous flesh, it's a different kettle of fish, you might say. But they do have a really great hollow inside of them for putting lots of stuffing.
Mm-hmm.
Group, it wasn't a bad way to use one of those in an edible manner instead of just cutting them into a jack-o'-lantern and then throwing them away after Halloween.
And then there's spaghetti squash, which you can scoop out the egg-like fibrous meats and use that as if it were spaghetti with a spaghetti sauce, or you can use that as if it were grated zucchini and make some kind of thing like salmon patties or cakes with eggs. We like to do that with duck eggs.
Uh-huh. Now, I've never tried it done like that. I have tried it as replacing pasta. And I have to admit, despite the fact that most of my family absolutely loves spaghetti squash, I did not like it. I found it, like, ick.
We all have
that special. Yeah. I will have to try it in the form of a patty, or to use it in as like a grated zucchini or something, because mm-hmm. maybe I will like it that way.
Maybe.
With the way things are as it stands, I will never grow spaghetti squash because I didn't like it.
Mix it with some cream time and make a kind of hoe cake. See what you think.
Yeah, I'll try some different things with it because mm-hmm. it was just one of those things I went, yeah, that's interesting, but I won't bother again. And then, too, you know, this time of year, for a lot of people, they're looking at a long, cool spring. And that's when they grow a lot of the things that people in the South would grow in the wintertime. Mm-hmm. And there's some strange vegetables like kohlrabi. You can't buy it in the grocery store.
I've seen it once.
Oh, have you? I've never seen it in the grocery store.
Well, it was it was the grocery store that all the hoity-toities go to. It was there.
Well, Robbie, we absolutely loved it raw and just ate it sliced and like chips dipped with a dip.
Mm-hmm.
And our favorite dip happens to be a ranch dip made with yogurt.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, instead of the sour cream. Mm-hmm. And mayonnaise and whatnot that a lot of people you like to use, mm-hmm. we would use non-fat yogurt, and it was great. So that was always our.
Oh, terrific.
And yeah, a little healthier for you than the original version, you might say. And now with the Greek yogurts being so thick and wonderful, they weren't available I can remember when I needed thick yogurt, you know, lining a colander with cheesecloth and then dumping in the plain yogurt and having to let it sit overnight to drain out some of the moisture so that I had yogurt that was thick enough to use.
So I just checked here the isolation distance recommended for squash and pumpkins. It's 1,500 feet.
Well, I'm afraid I couldn't do that in my yard.
Mm-hmm.
And I would have to know pretty much what everybody in my neighborhood is growing.
There you have it.
So, yeah, I don't think saving seeds from my squash would be a good
idea. There are at least 12 gardens within 1,500 feet of me. So there you go. Even if I raised one variety, it would probably not breed true.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the reason for those seed catalogs.
Yeah. 1,500 feet is a fair amount of distance. My yard is roughly only 120 by 120.
That's
by people's standards. That's a huge yard.
Mm-hmm.
But it's much smaller than what I was hoping for.
Lettuce can do 50 feet. Peas can do 50 feet. But there are some things, beets and chard, they will cross with each other within half a mile.
Ah, I didn't know beets and chard were even related.
There you have it. Chard is actually a beet that doesn't have a beet on it.
Mm-hmm.
So you're growing it for beet greens, in effect.
Okay. Now, I have to admit, I love rhubarb chard with the red stems,
mm-hmm.
and I always use that to make green eggs for my kids.
Excellent.
Green eggs and ham. Yeah, we would chop up the chard, and it would be... Sometimes it would get mushrooms, sometimes it didn't.
Mm-hmm.
Even the ham, you know, that was not an always thing, but, you know, diced ham in with it and just sauté it a little bit. Until it was nice and limp, and then you poured in your beaten egg and scrambled it all up together, and we had our green eggs to go with our Dr. Seuss story.
Then there's carrots. They not only cross with other varieties of carrot within 1,500 feet, but they will cross with Queen Anne's lace. We have plenty of that here, so that kind of eliminates seed saving from carrots, which is too bad because you can save carrot tops if they still have the green on, and
uh-huh.
Dip them in a little bit of root compound or in some willow water that's had willow wand steeped in it. Pop that in the ground, keep an eye on it, and you're already into the second year of your carrot, and you can collect the seeds. But, of course, you have to be away from Queen Anne's lace or other carrots.
Uh-huh. Yeah, you know, I haven't investigated my entire hood to find out how much gardening anybody does.
Mm-hmm.
I know that the one neighbor did have some turnip greens, but I don't know if she does a summer garden as well or if that was just, you know, something she did this year or what the deal is. So, yeah, I know who's got pecans in the neighborhood.
Hmm.
Most of us do.
But it's not as bad as it sounds. For example, with carrots, we think, oh my, somebody's bound to be growing carrots within 1,500 feet of me. Well, yeah, but they're pulling them up and they're throwing the tops away. And so, you know, a carrot's got to go to seed to be a problem to you.
And that takes 2 years.
That's right.
So, yeah. That's not something that's going to happen real quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know that, you know, a lot of things will also self-sow. Or there's also what we called volunteers.
Mm-hmm.
From your compost pile, often if you don't get your compost hot enough, seeds can germinate from it.
And we usually find some squash there. And it'll be squash that can contaminate seeds of squash or pumpkins if you're hoping to keep any seeds from them.
Now, I know that my mother has had tomatoes is the most common one for her.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them have been good, and some of them have not done diddly squat. But She's had tomatoes often volunteer from the compost pile.
We have them come up everywhere. Frequently we don't see them. For example, one part of the garden is always what is called a Three Sisters garden. So it's corn, green beans, and squash or pumpkins.
Uh-huh.
And it gets really thick in there. It's just a wild morass of vegetation. Towards the end of the year, I'm poking through there, checking to see if the corn is ready to take. I'll come across tomatoes I didn't know I had. And they're invariably these little red things about 2.5-3 inches in diameter, which are they're just wonderful for all kinds of uses. But they always surprise me for some reason.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I have, okay, this was gardening in Arizona, but one year I had planted a half dozen yellow pear tomatoes beside my chicken house.
Mm-hmm.
And probably 2 weeks after I had planted them, we had cut down a very large dead cottonwood tree. And it had been brought down alongside the chicken house. Right alongside that bed. Well, in the commotion of getting this tree down, because it was a big deal to get this tree down, we had to have a boom truck and everything else because it had to be laid down just so in order to not damage our neighbor's house, our house, our fences, etc. So it had been laid down with a boom truck. Well, it had been laid down right beside these tomatoes, and I had forgot about them completely. Now, this is an area that you had to water in. And probably a month or 2 months later, I was out cutting on this large tree because I slowly cut it up myself. The trunk. I think we got somebody to come cut the trunk up. It's been a long time ago, but I think we did. Because that was beyond my axe and bow saw. But I was cutting up some of this tree that was laid down, and it's like, oh my goodness, I didn't know I'd forgot about these tomatoes. They were covered. And you could go out there every day with one of those 5-quart ice cream buckets, which are wonderful for picking things,
mm-hmm.
and fill it. I mean, I was taking tomatoes to church, giving them to people at work. Kids ate them like candy. They were everywhere, and they'd had zero care. And they grew like crazy for me.
And they hadn't been watered?
They hadn't been watered, they hadn't been weeded, they hadn't been taken care of at all.
That's a little bit like a hugel culture.
I guess, yeah. So, yeah, that was the pear tomatoes for me. The pear tomatoes were something that I always grew them easily in the desert. I've never tried here. I should plant pear tomatoes because they were the foolproof one, along with the Italian paste tomato. That was another one that did well for me in the heat. I haven't tried them in the South, but maybe, you know, going back to the basics and planting that familiar variety, it would do well here. I'm not sure.
You have to look for your local supplier, I suppose.
Well, I've tried the locally supplied varieties.
Mm-hmm.
I have never had one produce a tomato that was ever got big enough to eat.
Mm.
So, you know, I've tried the local heirloom varieties. I've tried the locally available hybrids. I've had zero success. Now, I know that they can be grown because we have U-Pick farms with tomatoes in this area.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, these people sell to farmers markets and grocery centers and whatnot, in addition to doing their U-Pick operation. So I know that if you can raise tomatoes commercially, I should be able to raise them in my garden.
Mm-hmm.
All I have to do is get it right.
Well, looking at this list here that has about 300 suppliers by state, and I don't see Alabama, Mississippi, or Louisiana listed. How about
uh-huh.
that?
Yeah, well, I know Alabama, there's huge nurseries
uh-huh.
that supply the entire South with stuff.
It must just be a gap. They've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 different groups in Florida the chia growers, eons, Florida mycology research, growing crazy acres, organic sanctuary, QR seeds, the pepper gal, and self-reliant strategies. So obviously something grows in the South.
Well, yeah, many things grow in the South. I mean,
that's right.
It literally is a battle for people who want to have a yard that is not au naturel.
Mm-hmm.
It's literally a continual battle, things from growing.
Mm-hmm.
So growing things here is not a lot of work. It's sort of a case of keeping it from drowning, keeping it from cooking, and keeping the fungus off.
There you go.
So if you have varieties that are fungal resistant and are tolerant of the too much rain too often and then not enough rain once in a while, because here, if it goes a week with no rain, it's practically a drought.
Now, are you aware of the Seed Savers Exchange?
Yes, that was one of the seed catalogs that I got this fall, this spring.
Okay.
Seed Saver Exchange, Baker Creek Heirlooms, which we had one of their Garden Answer people come on.
Mm-hmm.
And after Mardi Gras is over, we are going to see about bringing on some people that are specialists in various types of gardening and seeds and whatnot.
That's right.
And I'm hoping to even full of Native American gardeners.
I was on with that gentleman, and as a result of his being on your show, I bought Baker Creek for this year.
Uh-huh.
Instead of Fedco, and we're going to see how those do.
Well, I know that out of all the seed catalogs I've ever seen, Baker's Creek catalog is the most gorgeous.
It is comprehensive.
Yeah, it's just got wonderful pictures, a lot of information. When you read about the various varieties, I remember reading about them in other catalogs, and I feel like Baker's Creek is probably giving me a much more accurate representation of what I can expect from this rather peculiar heirloom variety. Right down to, there's a melon that is often marketed as the vine peach. And most of us that have been gardening a while have seen it. We may not have ever tried growing it. I've never tried growing it. But it also appears in Baker's Creek catalog, but they don't call it a vine peach. I don't have my catalog right here with me. But they tell you, you know, what it's like in terms of being a melon and how it is used.
Uh-huh.
That's useful information to me. Rather than convincing me that this melon is going to be just like having my own peach tree, which I will be sorely disappointed, I'm afraid, you know, knowing that it can be used in many ways similar, but it's not a real appetizing melon as a melon. Okay, I have a reasonable expectation of what performance is going to be.
Well, the thing to know with Seed Savers is they have this public catalog that they send out, and I received that. But if you go to their website or look in their catalog, you'll see that there's this thing about membership. And members also receive a very large, it may be entirely online now, but I've got it for several years. It's like a telephone book. You open it up, and there are all these entries organized by locality of people who are saving seeds to contribute to the seed database or seed bank at Seed Savers. And so if I go in there, I'm in the Eugene, Oregon area, I can look in this thing and I can see that there are like 9 different people in my county who are working with Seed Savers and are willing to exchange seeds with me if I have some seeds to exchange with them. And so I recommend membership because then you can get involved in the kinds of activities that result in there being a Seed Savers Exchange catalog. And these are locally adapted varieties.
That is something useful. In addition, for people who are growing their garden in containers or in very, very small areas. I discovered something this year at our local Walmart. And the 20-cent packages of seed, there's not very many seeds in them. But if you're planting a 4-foot row of carrots, there's plenty of seed for that.
Mm-hmm.
There were limited varieties, but a number of them were non-hybrid, traditional heirloom varieties. I think herbs, there were carrots, there was a number of vegetables available. And that's a really inexpensive way for someone to plant a little bit of something, because many people are going to be like me, and an entire package of seeds of a particular type may be way more than what you're going to be planting.
Mm-hmm.
And while you can keep them cool and dry and try using them again next year, there's going to be issues about viability often. You're going to have poor germination rates.
Mm-hmm.
Some plants, the seeds keep longer than others.
Mm-hmm.
And in addition, there's the hassle of keeping them cool and dry and then remembering where you're keeping them cool and dry. Remembering is usually the trick. Yeah.
We keep ours in a wooden index card box, the 5x7 size.
Uh-huh.
And that index card box lives on top of the crispers in the refrigerator year-round.
Uh-huh. That's a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
So that does kind of limit where it would be lost at as well.
Hopefully. We also keep a list on the whiteboard in the dining room, which is where our wood heat stove is. Right across from our chairs are these two whiteboards on the wall. They're like 3x5 feet. And there is a map of the premises on the upper whiteboard with 18 beds all laid out and numbered and named. We know that this bed belongs to me and this bed does not. And the lower whiteboard is loaded up with what fruit trees are on hand at this time and how much watering they need, because new ones need to be established, and also a list of the vegetable seeds on hand, both those that we raised ourselves and those that we bought.
Uh-huh. So very organized and yet simple about the organization.
That's right. It's not in the computer. It's not in a notebook that we can lose. It's right there on the wall. And things have settled down to the point where we don't have to add or take away very much from it anymore, because we're becoming set in our ways.
Uh-huh. Right. Yeah, and when I was exploring what I could do, because no matter what I did, unless I had a small fortune to bring in professional tree crew, I could not create very much sunny space in this yard, because I've got 4 or 5 large live oaks. And for people who are not familiar with live oaks, they're very spreading and picturesque and shady, and they drop leaves and acorns practically year-round.
Oh.
And they have leaves all winter, too, because they are evergreen. But they're kind of a messy tree, but they're the ones that everybody associates with. And they are wonderful in the heat of the summer to be under.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not wonderful to try and garden under, because their roots are frequently protruding out of the ground. And it can be dense shade in some places underneath these trees.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, okay, I know you can grow things under trees. When I started exploring the varieties of plants that you can use underneath trees, or that have to be, a number of medicinal herbs, culinary herbs, etc., like shady woodland places.
Ooh. You can grow the red chard there, too.
Well, in addition, some fruit trees, like the pawpaw, are understory trees. They don't like to be in the blaring sun on their own. They like to be with dappled light underneath a larger tree. So planting those where they get shade part of the day, they will be much happier. So it's not completely the, I guess, disappointment of too much shade that I thought I was looking at. Instead, it's like shade can be an advantage.
Right. It's not a total loss. You've got your salad greens, cooking greens. You can do some root vegetables, herbs, and peas and beans.
Right. And even the protruding roots. You know, I can remember when I was a kid, we had a dead tree that had been lightning struck in the yard, and it had roots that were exposed above the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother created one of the most gorgeous rock gardens in that area. People would come from all over the neighborhood and bring friends and relatives from other places to come see the rock garden.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't that she had anything exotic in it. It was mostly marigolds and moss roses and, you know, simple plants that grew in there. And she did have a couple of roses and whatnot in there and planted bulbs and stuff, too. But it was very, very pretty. And there's no reason why you cannot use the exposed roots as a landscaping asset.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. I'm trying to be quite positive and see the silver lining on my shady cloud,
mm-hmm.
Along with the steep slopes, because our yard sits probably 4 to 6 feet, depending on where you're at, above the street.
Mm.
And so you have this really steep slope to a ditch, and then on the other side of the ditch is the street. And I've discovered that even though I was not crazy about this particular feature, the ditch is a fantastic way to stop a toddler from dashing onto the street as they're being pursued by a grandparent that's not as fast as they are, because they go head over heels, literally, and you can now... Ditch is wonderful. I've learned about that. And the steep slope... there again, it becomes a tripping hazard for dashing toddlers. In addition, people don't walk on your lawn.
That's helpful.
Yeah. I mean, this particular neighborhood has no sidewalks. apparently, it was created in the era of the automobile, and no one has ever seen a need for sidewalks, so there are no sidewalks at all. If you are walking somewhere, you walk on the side of the road and hope nobody runs over you. So far, I've been fortunate. When I'm walking, I haven't been run over. Otherwise, I guess I'd be giving the radio show from a hospital bed. But yeah, the ditch isn't as bad as I thought. And it does mean that the yard drains fairly well when we get a downpour, which, living in Mississippi, we do frequently. So it's not a bad thing. So, you know, even when you look at your yard and your acreage or whatever, and you see features that are not what you were hoping for,
mm-hmm.
like with me, it's much smaller and it's much shadier than what I wanted,
mm-hmm.
That isn't necessarily a bad thing.
It's nice when it's not a bad thing.
Yes, yes. And so you can often, with a little research, you can find things that make it much easier to cope with,
mm-hmm.
And turns those negatives into positives.
Well, we're fenced all the way around, the entire perimeter, and so we've made much of that into what's known as a chicken moat. So the chickens and the ducks live underneath the fruit trees, which are also in the moat. And they clean up fruit there and clean up insects that like the fruit trees. And in the winter, a gate is opened, and they also get to be in the garden. And then they're chased out in February, and the gate is closed. And so there's actually two sets of fences for that purpose, kind of like a donut. We live in the hole in the donut, and the birds live in the donut itself.
Mm-hmm. Now, I live in a small town.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't gone to check at the city hall yet to see whether or not poultry is allowed. In the South, I've discovered some areas will ignore it, some don't mind it, and some will hunt it down like it is a terrorist organization.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, I haven't heard any roosters in the neighborhood. That doesn't mean that it's forbidden, but I'm like, okay, would I be better off to take the tactic that is often recommended to just ask forgiveness after you do it? Or should I be safe rather than sorry and contact the city hall before I did anything of the sort?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I probably, most small towns even don't allow roosters, and it's because of the noise. And having raised chickens that were destined for the soup pot and bought straight run chicks, mm-hmm. I know how loud, 100 chicks that are mostly roosters can be.
And they are mostly roosters. I don't know how that works.
Yeah, I've often wondered about that. How straight is that run, really? But yeah, they don't just crow early in the morning. They crow 24 hours a day, and mm-hmm. they sound horrible when they're learning to crow. Hmm. That was actually my daughter when she was a baby. Her first mimic sounds were the sounds of a young rooster learning to crow at like 4 months old. Mm-hmm. She became quite a good mimic of chickens and other animals, as a matter of fact, which some people might say was indicative of some flaw on my part. But anyhow, she did mimic the sound of a young rooster, which they, that traditional, it's more mm-hmm. like somebody's throttling something out there. It's just squawking, growling, goofy noise.
It takes practice.
A lot of practice. And they start young.
Mm-hmm.
So I can understand why many towns forbid the presence of roosters.
Every town is different. We used to live in Springfield, Oregon, before we were out here in the country. And we could have a dozen ducks. We could have had 3 hens. We did not have hens, but we could not have had a rooster.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And for people who are not familiar, ducks, actually the laying ducks, will lay more eggs per pound of feed or per hen than chickens.
This is correct.
And they don't taste funky. The only thing I found that was the downside is ducks dabble in their water. And if you live in a warm climate, mm-hmm. dabbling in the water with a bill full of feed means that they're soon brewing some foul-smelling beer in their water container.
Mm-hmm.
And the water had to be changed at least once a day, or it became more than foul.
We're twice a week in the summer and once in the winter. And frankly, I can't tell one egg from another, except it's a lot bigger.
Right, and if for those who are bakers, the best eggs for baking a cake, I was always told, in personal experience, I would have to agree with it, the best eggs for cake baking were turkey eggs.
Oh, there you go. I did not know this.
Yeah.
We use our goose eggs for that.
I have to admit, I have a personal prejudice against geese, because I don't care if you're the one that raised them or not. They're great mm-hmm. watchdogs, but they'll get anybody and everybody. They don't discriminate. Friend or foe, neither, no difference. the geese, I was sure that if you raised them yourself, they would be just fine. Wrong. I've never been successful at being a goose herder. They honk. They are foul-tempered.
We haven't had much trouble with Susanna, but Sylvester is no longer with us because he murdered a prized duck. So there you have it.
Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah. I don't know how my dogs would be, especially the oldest and largest and the most lethal one in terms of animals would be, around poultry. I've never had poultry since I've had her.
Mm-hmm.
I know she hates birds and she kills other things like possums and rats.
Mm.
But, her rat-killing habits after Katrina in New Orleans didn't. It sort of made her a friend of the neighborhood because the rats had kind of left any place that flooded, and where we lived didn't flood. So we had this sudden influx of rats outside.
Mm-hmm.
And not only are they dirty and disgusting, but they do an immense amount of damage as far as wiring goes and everything. I mean, they
can do that.
And having a dog killing rats is a huge plus.
It's a service.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I can remember as a kid when they would shell corn out of a silo or corn bin.
Mm-hmm.
There was a guy in the area that had what was called ratten dogs.
Mm-hmm.
And he would bring his dogs out, and as they were shelling corn, the dogs would be killing rats. And he'd usually have a couple bushel baskets of them. And that was, you know, on a farm that had cats and stuff, too. And the rat-killing dogs, which they were rat terriers of some sort, probably mm-hmm. bred to any show standard, but they were the ratten dogs. And they kill far more.
We have one cairn terrier, weighs 11 pounds. And he will take them on.
Yeah, yeah. The dogs can kill them quickly. I know Red's habit is she snatches them up, she crunches, and then she throws them down on the ground. Apparently, she's been bitten. And if they move, she grabs them again and crunches again and throws them down. Now, most things, like if she kills doves or you know, other animals like the birds like that, she eats them. She will not eat a rat.
Mm-mm.
Absolutely. She will not eat a rat. She will ignore it forever.
Well, she never sailed with Magellan, did she?
I guess not. She won't eat a rat. Yeah, she regards them as disgusting.
Hmm.
So, yeah, that was the deal with her. Now, I know we are getting down to the wire on our time. So, you want to tell everybody how to find your blog and find your videos and your book.
Well, there are links from all of these to the others, so if you make it to one of them, you'll be able to find them all. And the blog is called A Way to Live, and it's not the way to live, it's a way to live. So, Risa's Home. blogspot.com. That's RISASHOME, one word, .blogspot, one word, BLOGSPOT.com.
Okay. Yep. It's been great to have you come on and chat with us about gardening and all this optimism for spring. It's probably even more pronounced for those who are living in cold climates and are currently looking at a snowstorm or a snow mm-hmm. on the ground, but here in the South it's unseasonably warm, and I'm still, you know, anticipating, you know, the coming year in the garden. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it is fun, and it's a lot of optimism. But though, we are pretty much out of time, folks. So, I hope that tonight's program has given you plenty of food for thought, as well as more illumination for your personal journey towards truth. Tune in again next week as we bring another guest, another topic, and a whole new idea for your consideration. You've been listening to The Dawn of Shades, and I'm your host, Gia Scott, and good night.
Together, we are Second Sight NYC, a parapsychic radio show based out of New York City.
Join us each week as we journey into the unknown. Let's cross the threshold of reality together.
We take a fun and no-nonsense approach to our show, and we love to interact with our audience. Each week, you can expect a great guest, interesting topics, and strong opinions of Stephanie.
As well as rapid readings, psychic dream interpretations, and the gemstone of the week. And don't ask us a question that you don't want an answer to.
Give us 2 hours of your time to inform, enlighten, and entertain you. Let the journey begin.
Join us.
Light up your night with The Kevin Smith Show. Hi, this is Kevin Smith. Join me Monday through Friday right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Breaking news. Strange black pyramid UFO ships over every major city on the Earth. People are exhilarated and scared. Reptilian strange creatures are beaming down. My God.